Welcome to Charles Dickens, A Brain on Fire, a series that digs deep into the life and works of one of the greatest novelists of all time. On the 9th of June, 1865, a train was passing over a small viaduct near the village of Staplehurst in the English county of Kent. Suddenly, the train derailed, and seven of its carriages plunged down through a hole in the bridge where a section of the line was missing. Charles Dickens was one of the passengers, and was lucky to escape with his life. This experience haunted him for the last 5 years of his life, and his ghost story, The Signalman, gives a harrowing insight into his trauma. One of the first newspaper reports of the crash from the Suffolk Chronicle reads as follows. All across the ditch, huddled and crushed and bruised into one another, lay the first-class carriages which formed the centre of the train. Through their broken sides and shattered windows were to be seen protruding human legs and arms and heads, and from every one of them was to be heard the piercing cry of human suffering. The following year, Dickens himself would write in The Signalman. I noticed at a carriage window on my side what looked like a confusion of hands and heads. I ran after it, and as I went along, heard terrible screams and cries. Here with us right now to talk about the crash and his new book, Dickens and Staplehurst, is Dickens's great-great-grandson, the actor and celebrated Dickens performer, Gerald Dickens. Gerald, welcome.
Great to be with you, Dominic. Great to meet you.
We're here because, well, for lots of reasons, really, but the main reason is Staplehurst, the Staplehurst rail disaster that your great-great-grandfather was involved in and was very, very lucky to escape.
Absolutely. It was an extraordinary time in his life in 1865. He was traveling back from France, where he had been with Ellen Ternan, his mistress, and her mother. And now we are pretty certain that she gave birth to either a stillborn baby or a baby that died very soon after birth. And this tragedy overwhelmed them all. And they left France to return to London, where they had to continue their relationship in great secret. It wouldn't be done for such a hero of the family as Charles Dickens was to be having a relationship with a lady who was not his wife. So the three of them were traveling back from Paris to Boulogne and from Boulogne to Folkestone and from Folkestone to London. And it was during that leg of the trip, as the train was traveling through the county of Kent in the southeast of England, that they came across an area of the line where work was going on. A bridge was being repaired. The rails had been removed. There was a gap in the line, and there was no warning, and the train went straight over. And Dickens was in one of the only carriages that was not crushed and destroyed, and was incredibly lucky, as you said, to survive. He clambered out of the carriage and helped in the rescue effort. But it was a terrible disaster. 10 people killed, many, many more seriously wounded. That's the basics of that day in Staplehurst.
Am I right that essentially then, with the essential hole in the line, that the front carriages, the front carriage that Dickens was in and the front engine, they were essentially airborne for the moment?
They jumped it. Yeah, and the remarkable thing, there were so many aspects of that day that led to the crash. I mean, like any disaster, if you read an inquiry to an air crash now, if any one single thing hadn't happened, then the crash could have been avoided. But there were so many pieces of regulation that were ignored or incorrectly pursued. One of the main ones was a signalman was sent to wave a red flag if a train should approach the gap in the line. And he was supposed to be standing 1,000 yards away. Now, in fact, he was only standing 500 yards away, which meant the train had no time to stop before it reached the crash. Now, that's actually what saved Dickens' life, because the train still had so much speed by the time it reached the work in the line that, as you say, it actually jumped the gap. So the locomotive, the tender, a guard's van, and the first-class carriage that Dickens was travelling in, they all managed to clear the gap. And it was the carriages immediately behind that all plunged down into the river. And you know, as part of my research for the book I've written about the crash, I went to look at some Victorian rail carriages, and you see the ironwork underneath, typically Victorian, huge, heavy weight, over-engineered things. But the carriages themselves are just flimsy wood. So each was just crushed as the next carriage came down, and they all just plunged one into another. Absolutely terrifying. So Dickens was unbelievably lucky.
Well, yes, and something else, having read your book, Dickens and Staplehurst, which is extraordinary, and I recommend everyone, of course, to go out and buy it and read it.
But you are a gentleman, Dominic.
Not at all. But there is something that you did that you mentioned right at the very start, which was to visit the site itself. I would love to hear more about that, because that in itself could have been an extraordinary near-death experience for you, perhaps.
It seemed a good idea at the time. I was performing that day in a theatre very close to the scene of the crash in the town of Ashford in Kent, and Staplehurst is a very short journey from there. So I decided, as this was right at the beginning of my research, I would go and visit the scene of the crash. And I had 10 red roses with me to lay up the site in honour of the 10 victims. And I drove to the site and parked the car as near as I could to the railway line, and found that the gate into the field where the actual bridge is was barred and padlocked and barbed wire and signs on it saying, do not enter, no trespassing, private property. So I climbed over the gate like any good Dickens would and made my way through the field following the path of the railway line, which is still an active line. It still links Folkestone to London today. And eventually the line reached the river. Now, the river is very small and it meanders all over the place in that part. It's sort of marshland, really. But eventually I found the point where the railway line and the river met. And I couldn't quite get to the river itself. It had been raining over the past 2 days and the fields were quite flooded. But I wanted to get right to the scene of the crash. So I stepped forward a little bit more and put my boot in a puddle. And the puddle was an awful lot deeper than I expected. And suddenly down, down, down my boot went, and the water came up and flooded over the top of the boot. And I've got to get out of here. So I put my other foot down to brace myself to lift my sodden boot out of the water, at which point the mud underneath me gave way. And I just went straight down into this flood, right up to my neck. I mean, absolutely no kidding. I was completely submerged up to my shoulders in muddy water. Now, of course, I had a great sense of importance of things in that I had my camera and my phone that I was holding above the surface so they didn't get destroyed. And I was scrabbling not to go under completely. Now, of course, nobody knew I was there. I was trespassing in a field. And at that moment, there I was in the same river as the victims of the crash had been. And it sort of was humbling. Quite apart from all of the documentation I read as research, just that moment, I hadn't actually planned to do quite such specific research, but it was a very strange moment. And I managed to eventually pull myself out. I grabbed a little branch and some roots and managed to get myself out. I was soaked. I was just dripping from head to foot. And I laid the flowers on the embankment and trudged back to the car. And as I was walking back, the farmer appeared, the farmer who had barred and gated and put signs up and everything else. And he met this sort of big draggled figure squelching across his field. And I decided the best thing to do was to brazen it out rather than trying to apologize or anything else. So I just said, good morning. Good morning. Yeah. Just been visiting the site of the rail crash at the bridge over there. And he sort of looked at me up and down and tried to work out what I was. And he said, Charles Dickens. And it's extraordinary in this field, me dripping, soaking. He had no idea who I was. Those were the first two words that came to him. And it made me realize still, and you must find it as well, the amazing power that the character, the celebrity of Charles Dickens still wields today. It's extraordinary.
Was there any doubt in the farmer's mind, a bit like in The Signalman when you encounter that man? Did he think you were an apparition?
Maybe that was it.
Your great-grandfather brought back to life.
Do you know, the best thing would have been if I'd been short on time and I'd been in costume for my show. They're walking across the field in full Victorian.
But there's something else from that story. I mean, that is an extraordinary story. And I love all that detail that you've given us there. But there's something else, which is, am I right that thinking that the crash, it was almost fortuitous that the crash happened in June so that the river was mostly dried out?
It was. Actually, you know, you read some accounts of the Staplehurst crash, and it talks about the train plunging off the embankment down into the river below. It's actually, as I've said, it's almost marshland. The river is almost nothing more than a stream at that point. And the embankment is a matter of just 10 feet high. It's not a great big chasm that the train plummeted into. And you're right, actually, some of the victims, I think, did drown, but only because they were trapped under the weight of the carriage they were riding in under the water. But it wasn't deep, you're right.
How do you feel personally towards your great-great-grandfather? Because I see, you know, if you watch the programme, Who Do You Think You Are? And it's a big revelation to people who their ancestors are. Obviously, for a long time, you've known who your great ancestor is. But do you feel a sort of personal connection that's just for you somehow?
Well, yes, and you probably feel it as well. And that's theatre. It's, to me, that's what fascinates me about him. He was such a passionate theatrical man. He loved theatre. And when I'm performing a piece that he created, you can see the hand of a theatrical man in the way he edits, in the way he creates a script. You know, Sykes and Nancy, The Murder of Nancy, is an extraordinary script, which isn't just lifted straight from Oliver Twist. It's carefully manipulated and paced and beautifully draws an audience in. And we as an audience are in the eyes of the spy, which means we don't see everything and we don't hear everything. We just hear what he hears. And that almost makes the audience an accessory to the crime. It almost makes them implicit. It's sort of like a great Hitchcock. You know, you're drawn in. And that's the connection I feel to Dickens, because that's always been my background. I've always been involved in theatre since I was 9 years old. And that's what fascinates me. To me, it's much more him as a person rather than his works. I'm not a scholar of any kind. I'm not an academic. I love his works. But it's him as a personality with all the frailties and confusions and difficulties. You know, you can see that actor's bravura sort of covering up any insecurities he might have by this larger than life image and way of living his life. That's my Dickens.
You're talking about the bravura of the man. There's a fantastic moment in your book where there's someone on the railway platform criticizing Dickens for strutting up and down the dock with the air of a man bristling with self-importance.
Isn't that a great description?
Yeah, because obviously he was a huge show off, wasn't he? And made no apology. But that's what's wonderful about him, isn't it? And
absolutely.
There's something else that I was very interested to ask you about was what led you, I think this is right, what led you to want to perform Dickens yourself was seeing the RSC production of Nicholas Nickleby. Is that right?
Not quite.
Okay.
That's what first made me realise what an amazing author and scriptwriter Charles Dickens was. Up to that point, I was 17 when I saw that production at the Old Witch Theatre. And up to that point, I had nothing to do with Dickens other than had Oliver Twist forced on me at school for my O-levels, which I hated. I never even finished reading it. I actually quoted the Lionel Bart musical in my O-level exam because that's all I knew. So actually, up to that point, I'd very firmly distanced myself from Charles Dickens. I had no interest in him or his work at all, which was kind of difficult because my father was a huge Dickens fan and a huge Dickens expert. And our house was always filled with all the biographies and every edition, and Dad was always writing speeches and articles, and we had, you know, the best academics and scholars coming to dinner, and when as a family we were invited to see the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of Nickleby, it was New Year's Eve 1980. Now I was 17. I really didn't want to be in a theatre watching Dickens on New Year's Eve. That's not the place I would have chosen to spend years.
And also, it's 8 hours long or something.
Yeah. It was going to take up all of New Year's Eve. And I sort of grumpily went in. I presume the family were invited, and we went en masse. It was cousins and second cousins and everyone. And I assume we're invited because the theatre didn't have anyone who'd booked tickets for that night because they're all out partying and celebrating. So the Dickens family moved in en masse, and I just didn't want to be there. And 5 minutes within the start of the play, and I was absolutely riveted because it was theatre. It was exciting, and the characters were larger than life, and it was almost pantomime at places, you know, the villainous squeers and the pathos of Smike, and it was just brilliant, and I was on the edge of my seat, and the first half of 4 hours came to an end, and I just couldn't wait for the second half to start again. So exciting. So that's what got me into Dickens, and that's what fascinated me. The actual performing came 13 years later in 93, which was the 150th anniversary of A Christmas Carol's publication. And actually somebody approached me with the idea. It wasn't my idea at all. And they were raising money for a local charity and said, look, there's so much publicity going on this year about A Christmas Carol. Why don't we use your theatrical background, your talents, if you like, to recreate one of the readings that Dickens gave? And I didn't want to do it, but it was for charity. So I thought, all right, I'll do it once. Just do it once. And she talked me into a second night. So we did two nights, 10th and 11th of December, 1993. But you know, I wasn't really interested particularly. I'd never done any one-man theatre before. It didn't excite me. And the year passed on. I think she'd first approached me in the May of that year. And the year rolled on and I'd sort of was doing other stuff and had kind of forgotten about it. And then I got a call saying, yeah, I hope you're ready for December. We're thoroughly looking forward to it. We're starting to sell tickets. And, oh, my God, help. I've forgotten all about that. So I went to my dad and I said, look, I've been asked to do this reading of A Christmas Carol. I don't know where to start. I can't read the whole book. It would take 4 hours or 5 hours or whatever it is. What do I do? And he said, well, the best place to start is for Charles Dickens himself, because he edited it. So what's the point of you doing it again? You know, use his version. Here it is. He gave me a copy of the book. I thought, that's amazing. But how do I deal with all of the different characters? How do I do that? I don't know. And he said, just remember, Charles Dickens has done all the work for you. Which wasn't the groundbreaking advice I was really hoping for, I have to say. That didn't really move me on very much. Charles Dickens has done all the work for you. Okay. Thanks, Dad. So I took the book, and funnily enough, I actually found the exact copy I used the other day. I was looking through some old stuff, and there it was, and I'd written the dates and everything in. And so I thought, well, how do I get the characters? I don't know. Well, let's find out. Ebenezer Scrooge has to be the first person because everything revolves around him. So where do I go with that? Well, I'll look at the first description of him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone screw, just squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. He was hard and sharp. And suddenly, you just can't help yourself. You know this. You're him. Because it's all there. And Dad was absolutely right. Dickens had done all the work for me. I just read the line, and there was the character. Thank you very much. It was an extraordinary moment.
Yes, I think that makes sense, because what we know about Dickens is that I think in a lot of cases he spoke aloud everything he wrote. So he'd verbalized it in the mirror before writing it down very often.
But verbalized it and performed it. So not just the voice, not just the vocal side of it, but the expression and the way of standing and the body language, all of it. It's extraordinary. And often now, if I'm reading Dickens, I will just read passages out loud to myself because it makes them just pop off the page much, much more.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's exciting. So that's where it started, yeah.
With looking at the manuscripts in adapting it, do you ever draw things from the original novella, say, that you want to have back in? Yeah. So for example, you know, when you I know that you've done a solo, A Tale of Two Cities, and Dickens's manuscript of that is The Bastille Prisoner, isn't it? Which is just Lucy Manette and Laurie going to rescue the doctor in front, and you think, where the hell's Sidney Carton?
Exactly.
What the hell? Who cares about this bit? I don't mean it like that. But you think,
No, you're right. But that brings us back to also Sykes and Nancy. You know, Oliver never appears in that. Who cares what book it comes from? Oliver's not there at all. It is purely that little moment he wants to capture. So it depends what I'm doing. The Tale of Two Cities is a show. So I need the whole flow of the plot. Something like Sykes and Nancy, that I will tend to stick very much with his edit, because I think that is part of the performance, is how he created it. A Christmas Carol, I don't know if you find this, but my show lengthens every single year, because I go back and I reread it, like, I've got to have that passage in. I hate not saying that. So it's only going to be 30 seconds. I'll slip that in. You know?
Yeah, and it all adds up, doesn't it? It all adds up. What I find, I don't know if you found this, but looking at his manuscripts, his edits, his prompt copies, I'm so astonished at how ruthless he is with his own words.
Yeah,
whereas I'm way more protective of...
I quite agree. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So much narrative is just whipped out, which I find so sad. You know, if you want to see the dialogue, you can watch any of the movie versions that have been made. You know, that they all have the dialogue. So let's put back what they've taken out. Let's listen to Dickens's real language. I'm so with you on that.
Well, I'm glad you are. I feel that's authenticated my opinion. Then that's excellent. So the in terms then of you're performing The Signalman, and now with all that extra research you've done on Staplehurst, how has the Staplehurst experience informed that for you?
Whenever I perform The Signalman, I always talk about Staplehurst before. The Signalman was written a little more than a year after the Staplehurst rail crash. And in the intervening year, Dickens's dog had also been killed on the railway. It had been run over by a train. And it just seemed that the rail system was haunting him. And if you read the newspapers of the time, almost every day there's an account of yet another rail disaster somewhere. And it was a commonplace thing.
Yes, I was going to say one of the most poignant parts of your book is the fact that people on the train at Staplehurst are reading the account of a previous
just a couple of days before in Shrewsbury. And it seems commonplace that another railway crash on the British rail system is about as common as a party in Downing Street. You know, every day there's another one. It seems inevitable to me that Dickens wrote The Signalman as a means of sort of exercising this memory, this post-traumatic stress disorder, which he was for certain suffering. And it's interesting because he included The Signalman in a collection of stories, which were in the Christmas edition of All the Year Round, Mugby Junction. And most of them are quite light, comic, fairly typical Dickens fare, you know, what you'd expect to get from a Christmas number of his magazine. And then suddenly you get this one, The Signalman, which is more Edgar Allan Poe-like. It's not Dickens. It's intense. It's claustrophobic. It's dark. It's somber. And here is this stretch of railway line tormenting this poor signalman. So I've always prefaced a performance of The Signalman by talking about Staplehurst. Now, of course, the other amazing connection is Staplehurst happened on the 9th of June in 1865, which was exactly 5 years to the very day before Dickens himself died. He died on the anniversary of Staplehurst in 1870. So the writing of the Staplehurst book really came out of my desire to know more, so that I wasn't just traipsing out the same old sort of cliches about Staplehurst that I'd read in the biographies. I wanted to know a bit more. I wanted to know who was involved, who the other passengers were, how the day panned out, what the weather was like, what the boat was like, all these extra little details. And actually, it was lockdown that enabled me to do that. I managed to get to Staplehurst and to Boulogne and to Folkestone just before we hit heavy lockdowns in Britain, and the rest of it was done online research. It now gives me a real sense of why he wrote The Signalman and what was going on in his mind.
What I find interesting about The Signalman, I don't know if you've, this may be just my feeling, but when you read that opening and he's describing looking down and seeing The Signalman unfurling his flag and turning, there's a sort of, for Dickens anyway, there's a certain awkwardness in the description, isn't it, as he's recalling it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I mean awkwardness is quite the right way, but it doesn't have that free spirit, that freewheeling.
No.
It's almost like he's giving a witness statement.
Yeah, that's a very good description of it. And even then, in that very opening sentence, he can't actually see clearly. The sun is shining into his eyes and there's dark shadow down in the cutting and the signalman's facing the other way and he's in shadow. You're right. It's not a glowing description of every little aspect of the scene. It's interesting that change in height as well. He comes back to it at the very end of the piece. there's a difference between the sort of real world on the top level, on the path he's following, and then this other world down in the cutting. It's an extraordinary opening. And although it's very short, it's one of the most tiring pieces I do, sort of emotionally. And you find your body is so rigid and tense by the time you get to the end of it. Every muscle is sort of tense. I find it an incredibly exhausting piece to do.
Knowing about Staplehurst really certainly informs my reading of it. I mean, I think that underlying sadness, that desperate desire to know what's around the corner and to be able to prevent things from happening, bad things from happening. But of course, we're mortal and we're human and there's a limit to our perception.
And you know, the narrator gets drawn into that as well. He becomes wrapped up in the fear and the heaviness of the atmosphere, and then he has this guilt at the end of not being able to save the signalman. He should have done. He said, you know, I should have sent someone there to overlook what he did, and I didn't. And then he becomes reflective. He's thinking back. You know, he suddenly realizes the importance and the significance of the words that the engine driver has told him. What I love, Dickens was writing to try and rid himself of the memories or cleanse his mind of the memories of Staplehurst. He didn't set it at Staplehurst. He was still a big enough dramatist to realize that a 10-foot drop into a slightly muddy ditch wasn't going to be very impressive. So he created this superb setting in the Gothic tunnel mouth down in the deep cutting, which was probably based on another rail crash that received a lot of media coverage at the time near Brighton. And that very much fits the description of the signalman.
Yes. And was that the one that where the tunnel itself became a kind of blazing furnace? Was it that one or was it a different one?
No, that was the one that actually took place on the first anniversary of Staplehurst on the 9th of June, which I think was in Welling. And it was late at night and a goods train went into the tunnel and the boiler burst and it failed. It stopped. Another train, the signals weren't properly shown. Another train steamed in that was carrying tallow and tar. And that hit the back of the train that was knocking the wreckage onto the other line at the same time as a third train came in from the opposite direction. That exploded with this perfect storm of fuel, and there was a flue chimney going up into the daylight right above the crash, which acted as the perfect setting. And then the whole tunnel just burnt for 3 days, I think, before anyone could...
Unthinkable, isn't it? Looking at the names, you mentioned in your book also that when you see the names and in the inquest and everything, how that brought it very personally to life for you.
That was the first time I really decided I wanted to write the book and to research more. I'd started out on the research purely to give myself more fact about Dickens's involvement. But one of the first documents I found online was the official entries of cause of death into the official register. And suddenly you see these 10 names. There are 10 people, there are 10 families, there are 10 husbands or wives, there are children. And that's when I wanted to find out more about their stories.
Yeah. And is it Henry Benge, the foreman? Exactly. Poor guy. I was wondering, because obviously he carries the guilt, the blame. And how do you feel towards him reading all
I feel so sorry for him. I mean, he was, apart from anything else, when the inquest took place, the buck was gently passed all the way down and he was the very last person and it all came on his shoulders. Now, yes, his mistake on the morning of the crash led in part to it. He was reading the timetable for the day's proceedings on that stretch of railway line, meaning that he knew when he could take rails up, when they needed to be replaced. This work had been going on for 10 weeks and nothing untoward had happened up to then. He'd been absolutely fine. The problem was on that day, the fact that the train that was coming through, the express train, the one that Dickens was on, was what was called the boat train. So it met the boat at Folkestone, having come across the channel. Now, because of the tides in the channel, the train met the boat at a different time every day. And there was a very complicated timetable to allow for that. And Benge read the wrong page of the timetable. That was his big mistake. That was his only mistake, really. He read the timetable for the 10th of June, the following day, not the 9th of June. And the difference in time between the trains on the 2 days was 2 hours. That's how big it was. So the train on the 9th of June was due to come through at 3:15. On the following day, it was due to come through at 5:10. And that's what he thought. He thought he had 2 hours in hand. He didn't. But over and above that, there were so many regulations that were ignored, not only by him, but people higher up in the railway company as well. And if any one of those had been in place, the accident would have been prevented. The simple expedient of showing a danger signal at the previous station would have alerted the driver that something was up. It wasn't a thing I explored in the book, and I wish I had now, that actually this work had been going on for 10 weeks. Surely the drivers of the trains knew that. Surely a sense of caution over that stretch of line would have been just common sense, rather than flying through at 50 miles an hour, just the top speed the train did. I find that fascinating. You know,
that's a very interesting point.
It's sort of come to me since. The driver and the fireman, they both said, no, nothing to worry about. There was no danger signal. We know that that bit of track was flat and then suddenly, but they'd been over that line constantly over the last 2 months or so. Odd.
It is odd. Yeah. And a connection you also make in your book is you refer to the awful Paddington crash in 1999. Yeah. I remember that happening, actually. Mm. And I have to say, and I'm not saying this because of what we're talking about, but I genuinely was quite nervous about getting on trains after that. I don't know if you remember that at all. Or...
I do. I remember exactly where I was that day. And what's interesting about that account of the Paddington rail crash was... A member of an audience came up to me and sort of told me very quietly that he'd been involved in the Paddington crash, and he recognised what I'd been saying about the effect on Dickens in the years afterwards, the PTSD that Dickens suffered. And this gentleman said, I can understand that. I absolutely feel that. And I was the same. But it was a very specific set of circumstances that set off the fear in him, the phobia in him. He could be riding on a train through countryside. Didn't matter. But as he came into the outskirts of London, there was a certain set of noises, a certain set of points the train went over, a certain shadow coming in the window because of a tower block obscuring the view or whatever. And that suddenly would set him off. It was a real trigger.
Yeah. How did the PTSD manifest itself in Dickens then, travelling afterwards?
He would suddenly be overcome with fits of fear. His son and daughter, Henry and Mamie, both recorded in their memories of his life that he could just be in a hansom carriage in the streets of London, and if it went over a rutted part of the road and it would bounce, Dickens would suddenly grasp hold of the seat and he would stare at the floor and he would sweat and he would pant. And they could say whatever they liked to him, but he was completely unaware that they were there. Mm. He wasn't in a hansom carriage in the streets of London. He was in the railway carriage at Staplehurst again. It wasn't a memory of it. It was a physical re-manifestation of it. He was absolutely back in that place. And he said in the weeks afterwards, it wasn't the memory of the crash that disturbed him. It was the sights he saw during the rescue. It was the mutilation. It was the death. It was the suffering. That's what hurt him most. But these memories of Henry and Mamie seem to suggest that the actual physical terror of the moment of the crash was much deeper within him. Not a conscious fear, but deeply implanted within him. He would often stop a rail journey if he was traveling, especially on an express train. If the fear came on him, he would just leave the train at the next station and make his way on using either local trains, slower trains, or other means of transport. Of course, the problem with him was that he was absolutely at that time fully involved in his reading tours. And that meant traveling the length and breadth of the country. And the only way to do that in a fast enough time to allow him to pile in all of his performances was by train. So on the one hand, he was chasing his dream and doing what he loved doing most, performing. On the other hand, he was putting himself back in that situation again. And I'm sure that the strain he was going on led to his ill health during those last 5 years of his life, that he was never in good health from that time on.
Yes, it's very sad, really, isn't it? I feel like Staplehurst to him is a kind of awareness suddenly of his own mortality.
Yeah.
And from that moment onwards, and of course, as you mentioned at the start, he dies on the fifth anniversary of the day of that crash, which in itself is a kind of strange coincidence, isn't it?
It is. And apparently it's quite common, actually, I have heard, of sufferers of PTSD. An anniversary, a particular anniversary, can trigger a medical event.
Wow.
His stroke was actually on the day before, of course, but, I don't have serious academic proof of that, but I have been told that's quite a common thing.
Yeah, I can believe it. Something else that really stands out in the book is the moment where Dickens and Ellen Ternan and her mother are in the carriage, and it jolts and it's flying and it crashes. And she says something along the lines, "Let us join hands," or "Let us be friends."
Let us join hands and die friends.
And what do you take from that moment then?
I don't know. The conjecture in the book is inspired by Claire Tomlin's book, The Invisible Woman, about Dickens and Ellen. And, you know, she suggests that there was some sort of difficulty between them. If it's true, and we believe it is, that there had been a baby born in France shortly before, everything between them had changed. The relationship was suddenly a different one. And that line, "Let us hold hands and die friends," sort of suggests that at that moment they weren't, that something had happened between them, that there was a difficulty, there was a distance between them. It's also a very theatrical piece of writing by Dickens. He wrote that in a letter to Thomas Mitton a few days after the crash. And as the letter goes on, it sort of becomes more wordy and theatrical and blended. We only have his word in the letter that is what she said, and that is the case. But she was injured. She broke her arm in the crash, and he made great efforts to look after her and care for her in the days after the crash. He asked his manservant in London to continually take her a hamper of fresh food every day and vary it. And she told him that she'd lost a collection of gold jewellery she was travelling with. And Dickens went to great lengths to try and find that, which actually, in the end, gave the game away. He wrote to the station master at Charing Cross Station saying, I was travelling with a young lady in the coach and she lost all her gold jewellery. And it was engraved with the name Ellen. If you find it, please let me know. Suddenly, we had this... What's going on here?
Yes, and of course we talk about him, you know, reacting to the trauma and being very scarred by the experience. But as you know, and as it says in your book, I mean, he acted heroically on the day itself, didn't he? He really, really helped and assisted people and helped them as they were dying, and he also had the presence of mind, which I find extraordinary, to retrieve that manuscript of our mutual friend.
Well, yeah, I guess he didn't have it backed up to the cloud. can you imagine that? He'd been working on the latest part of our mutual friend, and that was hanging in his greatcoat pocket, which had hung on the hook in the carriage. Clambered down, spent 3 hours assisting. As he said, people were dying in his arms. He was pulling them from the wreck, and they were dead, and people were desperate to find their husbands and wives. And then finally, exhausted, he was about to get on a train to return to London and had the presence of mind to remember, oh, hang on, what am I supposed to be doing in London? I'm supposed to be delivering my manuscript to the office. I better go and get it. By which time his carriage had been lifted back onto the track. There's a famous photograph taken of the scene of the crash, and there's one carriage sat on the line, and that's the first class carriage that Dickens was in, that by that time had been lifted back onto the track, and Dickens was able to clamber in and retrieve the manuscript. It's extraordinary presence of mind, isn't it?
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? But when you went back to the site yourself, does that original bridge then still stand, or is it?
No. It's a modern concrete bridge, spanning the same river and in the same place. But no, it's a modern bridge now.
I find that reassuring, actually.
Yes, I mean, me too.
I'd love to ask you, Gerald. I'd love to talk to you about this new. If it is new, this new solo Dickens show that you've got, Mr. Dickens Is Coming. Have I got that wrong?
Actually, it's not new. It's the oldest one I do, apart from A Christmas Carol.
I completely missed that. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought A Christmas Carol was your first. No. Okay.
Christmas Carol was. And then in the year after I did A Christmas Carol, I thought, okay, well, I'm quite interested about this theatrical side of Dickens. When I'd first done A Christmas Carol, I'd purposely avoided doing any research into Dickens as a performer because I wanted it to be my show. I didn't want it to be just a recreation of his. So I didn't want to know every gesture, every expression, every way of phrasing something. I wanted to come to that myself. So it was only afterwards that I started reading about Dickens in the theatre and his performances. And I realized what an amazingly theatrical person he was. And then you start reading some of the characters and the way he wrote, as you touched on earlier, the performing to himself in a mirror and observing what he saw, that I thought, well, this is quite fun. If I could build up a show that is quite lighthearted, very easygoing, it's not going to be academic. It's not going to pander to those that know every comma and every bit of punctuation in all of Dickens. This is just going to be fun. And I want people to laugh and I want people to enjoy it. And I want to have some characters from the books in it. I want some of Dickens's own words from his diaries. I want observations of other people who worked and were around Dickens. I want my own perspective. So I put this show together called Mr. Dickens is Coming, which the title is taken from the fact that when he was going on tour, as soon as the bill posters were put on the walls in the cities he was going to perform at, you could hear a cry echoing from street to street and people would shout, "Here, Dickens is coming, Mr. Dickens is coming." So that's where the title came from. And it's very loosely based on Dickens' theatrical career. I've never put it on film before, and that's what we've done for the Charles Dickens Museum to stream over the birthday weekend, which was quite fun because, you know, it as well, filming at the museum, you suddenly think, hey, well, that's a rather useful picture we can use, or that's a nice little angle we can take, or, you know, I'm talking about lying on a sofa, so there's a sofa, let's lie on it. It was great to do that, but funnily, Mr. Dickens is Coming really hasn't changed very much since 1994 when I first wrote it. I keep meaning to, but then I look at it and think, well, why? It works just fine.
You know, I've often thought about that because I think with these solo Dickens performances, they don't necessarily date at all, actually. No. You know, you think of a theatre production that's that old, you might think, oh, they're going to have to update the soundscape or the lights or the scenery. But actually, you know, I know acting styles change over time, and you may find that as we develop, you know, you slightly modify certain things. But overall, no, I think it's absolutely timeless stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm very interested in what you said about how, though, when you were approaching A Christmas Carol, and probably the same for all of them, is that you didn't want to try and copy what Dickens himself had originally done. And I think that's absolutely the right approach. But what is amazing, and I know, I'm sure I saw an interview with you years ago where you talk about this, where you go back and just look at what he wrote. And you go, oh my God, he does that same thing that I thought.
Exactly. Because that was a bizarre thing. I just so purposely decided not to recreate what he did, that when I then came back and read the accounts of his readings, I thought, well, okay, I'm just doing what he did. You know, that was me thinking I was reinventing theatre. Nope.
No, at all. Well, I mean, it's definitely the right approach. It's definitely the right approach. Yeah, because historical reenactment isn't drama, is it? It's historical reenactment.
And
it doesn't really work.
Because nobody knows. Yeah. Nobody in my audience knows what Dickens sounded like or how he moved. You know, so what's the point? It's not like being a Queen tribute act or you know, something like that, where you've got a very definite, wow, that sounds just like. There's no point. Well, why not do the best show you can do? That's a much better way of approaching it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I suppose a final question for you is, what's coming after this? What have you got lined up for yourself?
Thank heavens. It seems like the world of people wanting to see Dickens shows is bursting into life after lockdown. I'm getting more inquiries this year than I have for a long, long time, which is great. I'm in the middle of relearning my Great Expectations script because I'm doing that in a couple of weeks' time, which is always a great, it's my favorite novel. And putting together that show was very difficult, but very exciting because it was so important to maintain the integrity of that novel. So not go chasing silly laughs, not, you know, mucking about with it. It had to be a good solid piece, and I love performing that. So that's exciting. Performing A Signalman a lot this year because of the book. Dr. Marigold, do you do Dr. Marigold?
I don't actually know Dr. Marigold at all. I don't know. I know of it, but I know nothing about it.
It's the loveliest thing for that very reason, because nobody knows it. When Dickens was performing, it was one of his main pieces. He did it again and again, and it was incredibly popular. And now nobody has ever heard of it, and nobody knows it. And it is the most beautiful bit of storytelling. Dr. Marigold is a fairground trader. He's a cheapjack. He sells goods from the back of a caravan. He travels around the country, sets up in the marketplace, sells his wares. He's talking directly to the audience, first person in character. He's cheerful, cockney, very fast-paced, very witty, great sales patter. You can imagine him in any marketplace on the back of his caravan selling away. So that's how it starts. He's not a doctor. That's his name. He was named Doctor because he was born on the highway outside the caravan because his father was a salesman as well, a cheap jack as well. And a doctor came to assist in the birth of this young baby on the roadside. And because they were so grateful to the doctor, they named the baby after him. So they called him Doctor. So there's all this stuff. And it starts and it's laughing and the audience is laughing. It's very quick sales pattern. It's great. And then suddenly there is a moment when he decides he trusts this audience. And he begins to tell his life story. And it is tragic. He had a daughter who was abused by her mother. The daughter was beaten and pulled by a hair. The daughter dies. The mother commits suicide in remorse. His dog dies. Everything dies. And at the base, there is still this positivity and this ability to bounce back. And while he's traveling around the fairgrounds, he hears of a little girl who is deaf and can't speak. She's mute, deaf and dumb, and she is abused. And he rescues her. He adopts her. And together they learn to communicate. They teach each other a sign language, a rudimentary sign language. And it's just beautiful. And the story goes from there. And if you read it, and please do read it aloud, perform it. It works so much better when you've got a physical person saying the words than it does when you just read it on paper.
Okay.
It's a great piece. And that's my favorite piece to perform. Of all the Dickens readings, that's the piece I love doing most.
Oh, well, I've taken your advice then. So if I mount my own solo show of that, it's entirely your fault that I do.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm happy. The more people that get to see Marigold, I'm more than happy.
Gerald, this has been such a lovely chat. I wish you all the best with your Signalman performances and your Great Expectations this year. And yes, everyone, please buy Dickens and Staplehurst and read it and learn more. Yeah. It's a wonderful book. And
it'd be great to get together. And I've always had this idea of getting lots of performers who do Dickens together and doing a sort of weekend festival.
But that's
all get together, and you know, the audience might be bored stiff, but we'd enjoy ourselves.
Which is the most important thing,
exactly,
I think.
Yeah. So let's look at that one day.
I've had the same thought myself. So it's obviously out there. Maybe it's your great great ancestor sort of commanding it.
Yeah,
from the
maybe we, pulling the strings.
Thank you so much. All the best.
It's been a pleasure, Dominic. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to Charles Dickens' A Brain on Fire. I'm trying very hard to keep adverts off this series, so if any of you listening would like to give a small donation or subscribe, there is a link wherever you're listening to this podcast where you can make a small donation, which would be hugely appreciated. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.